devotion,
Blog Talk Radio,
and dedication to those ideals. I want to thank all of you from all over this nation
when we heed
have come here
when the world
in support of solidarity day.
There are people dying.
I want to especially thank
to lend a hand and the truth, you know love is all we
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
That was co-wrote of Scott King. And I want to tell you, it's going to take a movement to stop the killing to save the babies. This is our healing night, Saturday night healing. I want to hear from co-wrote King, Dr. King with her. And she's going to be speaking. That was her singing. And Dr. King was in the background.
Ago that my late husband, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., stood in this very spot and told the nation about his dream. Yesterday marked the 15th wedding anniversary for me and my late husband. Your presence here today indicates to me your great love, devotion, and dedication to those ideals which my husband set forth in his dream and which you will continue to follow through until they are fulfilled. I want to thank all of you from all over this nation who have come here in support of this Solidarity Day. I want to especially thank the National Urban League under the direction of Dr. Whitney Young, and especially Mr. Sterling Tucker, the coordinator of this Solidarity Day, for the tremendous support that you have given the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in order to make this occasion possible. Now, I know Dr. Abernathy would do this, but I want to tell you how much it means to me personally, because it was my husband who conceived the idea of a poor people's campaign. And now I should like to read to you a telegram which I received from another lady who was just recently victimized by the same tragedy which my family and I were victimized by. Today, on this most important day for all Americans, my heart and prayers are with you. The finest memorial to Dr. Martin Luther King would be the tangible action our country takes now to implement the program he and my husband cared about so deeply. Signed, Mrs. Ethel Kennedy. And now I should like to sing for you, "Come by here, my Lord, come by here."
Mrs. King is preparing to sing a hymn. She's just spoken tribute to her late husband. She is now going to sing.
Oh, here, my Lord.
sitting in Papa that become a game to the Lincoln Memorial. This symbolic and historic spot where we have come several times before to present our case to the President, to the Congress of the United States, and to the American people. We are here because we feel a frightful sense of urgency to rectify the long-standing evils and injustices in our society, racism, poverty, and war. The Poor People's Campaign was conceived by my late husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., as America's last chance to solve these problems nonviolently. The sickness of racism, the despair of poverty, and the hopelessness of war have served to deepen the hatred, heighten the bitterness, increase the frustration, and further alienate the poor in our society. The rumblings of discontent from the disinherited, downtrodden, and dispossessed of our society have finally become united around the issue of poverty. The least of these, God's children, have been ill-housed, ill-fed, deprived of adequate jobs and educational opportunities, and barred from full participation in the political life of this nation. They have come to Washington seeking to better their conditions, and in so doing, they are dramatizing this nation, to this nation and to the world, the desperateness of their plight. In a nation so rich in natural resources and material wealth, the richest nation in the world, a nation founded on the principles of justice and equality for all, some 30 million of its citizens are denied access to the wealth that surrounds them. I'm speaking of the American Indians, the Mexican Americans, the Puerto Ricans, Black Americans, and the white poor, who all live below the poverty line. Too long have we uttered pious platitudes and made false promises to our less fortunate brothers. Our destiny is tied up with their destiny, and we are being forced to place the issues where they belong, squarely on the conscience of the American people. All of the problems we face in trying to build a community and a nation of brotherhood, which we need desperately, can be attributed to what I call the triple evils of our time: racism, poverty, and war. All three of these evils can be reduced to violence. We can therefore say that violence is a disease which threatens to destroy the basic fabric of which our society is built. The undergirding fact of love, understanding, justice, and peace. Racism in American society can be traced to the period of slavery in this country, when it was felt that Black persons were completely inferior to white persons. Perhaps racism can be traced to that dark period in our history when slavery became institutionalized for 244 years, and segregation was practiced for another 100 years. So you see, the roots of racism are very deep in the psyche of the American white man. All forms of economic, political, social, educational and religious exclusion of the black man from the mainstream of society can be attributed to racism. Therefore, racism means being deprived of human dignity, self-respect, and equal opportunities in education, of jobs, of decent housing, political and social endeavors. Extreme hatred and bitterness against the black man has been shown by the white man due to his racist tendencies. Often this hatred has manifested itself in the violence of lynchings and murders, by which many Negroes and white civil rights workers have been victimized, to say nothing of the crippling effects of segregation and discrimination which have been experienced. Racism is related to poverty, and that it is easy to display racist attitudes toward a minority group, whether they be black, red, brown, or yellow. When we talk about poor people, we are dealing with the class structure of society. Therefore, the poor white are similarly affected. Between the poor white and the poor black, red, yellow, and or brown, is that it is possible for the white poor to lose their identity as they become more affluent, because they do not carry the stigma of color as the society would refer to it. Poverty can produce the most deadly kind of violence. In this society, violence against poor people and minority groups is routine. I remind you that starving a child is violence. Suppressing a culture is violence. Neglecting school children is violence. Punishing a mother and her child is violence. Discrimination against a working man is violence. Ghetto housing is violence. Ignoring medical needs is violence. Contempt for poverty is violence. Even the lack of willpower to help humanity is a sick and sinister form of violence. The violence of war is understood by everyone. There is hardly a family which has not been victimized by the effects of war, in that a husband, a father, a son, or a brother has been wounded or killed in the line of duty. What a nonsensical and cruel way to try to resolve conflict. In recent months, when we as a nation have experienced the loss of two of the great men of our time through violent means, we have come to realize and understand the broad dimensions of violence in our society. The problems of racism, poverty, and war can all be summarized with one word, violence, which seems to be fashionable in our society. If we do not stop this madness, we will certainly destroy ourselves and the whole world. There is need for a creative approach to the crucial problems which we face in our nation and in the world. I believe firmly that the women of our country have been called at this hour to furnish the kind of forthright, honest, dedicated, and creative leadership necessary to bring about positive solutions to the difficult problems we face. The approach must be a non-violent approach, for the means must be in keeping with the end. Because these problems of our society, which I have discussed, affect the women of this nation so deeply, I believe that they will see the necessity of joining a campaign of conscience in which all ethnic groups, all religious persuasions, all economic circumstances, and all cultural backgrounds will unite to produce a solid block of woman power. And seeking solutions to the three evils of racism, poverty, and war, it is clear that there is need for a renewal of the great spiritual and moral insight embedded in our cultural heritage. We must dedicate and rededicate ourselves to making a society based on the principles of love, truth, nonviolence, justice, and peace. This does mean a kind of rethinking and reordering of values and priorities. Women, if the soul of this nation is to be saved, I believe that you must become its soul. You must speak out against the evils of our time as you see them. Those of us women who have been blessed with the privilege of bearing children have the sacred task of rearing them with a knowledge and understanding of our democratic heritage and the eternal values of love, justice, mercy, and peace. As women and mothers, we have a common concern for the happiness of our children and their families, to unite our efforts throughout the world. We must compel those governments which ignore human dignity, which deny freedom of the individual, which block social progress and national independence, to put an end to every sort of persecution. Somehow we must rid ourselves of racism and teach our children the meaning of true brotherhood. Our children must be taught to be concerned about and to develop a deep sense of appreciation for those who are less fortunate than themselves, the least of these. They must know that all of society is interrelated. What affects one directly affects all indirectly. Women must realize that the war in Vietnam is the most crucial and evil war in the history of mankind.
My dear friends of peace and freedom, I come to New York today with a strong feeling that my dearly beloved husband, who was snatched suddenly from our midst, slightly more than 3 weeks ago now, would have wanted me to be present today. Though my heart is heavy with grief from having suffered an irreparable personal loss, my faith in the redemptive will of God is stronger today than ever before. As many of you probably know, my husband had accepted an invitation to speak to you today. And had he been here, I am sure he would have lifted your hearts and spirits to new levels of understanding in his customary fashion. I would like to share with you some notes taken from my husband's pockets upon his death. He carried many scraps of paper upon which he scribbled notes for his many speeches. Among these notes was one set which he never delivered. Perhaps they were his early thoughts for the message he was to give to you today. I am sure he would have developed and delivered them in his usual eloquent and inspired fashion. softly read them to you as he recorded them. And I quote, Ten Commandments on Vietnam. Thou shalt not believe in a military victory. Number two, thou shalt not believe in a political victory. Number three, thou shalt not believe that they, the Vietnamese, love us. Number four, thou shalt not believe that the Saigon government has the support of the people. Number five, thou shalt not believe that the majority of the South Vietnamese look upon the Viet Cong as terrorists. Number six, thou shalt not believe the figures of killed enemies or killed Americans. Number seven, thou shalt not believe that the generals know best.
For you, how many of our hopes have been realized in these
12 short months. Never in the history of this nation have the people been so forceful in reversing the policy of our government in regard to war. We are indeed on the threshold of a new day for the peacemakers. But just as conscientious action has reversed the tide of public opinion and government policy, we must now turn our attention and the sole force of the movement of people of goodwill to the problems of the poor here at home. My husband always saw the problem of racism and poverty here at home and militarism abroad as two sides of the same coin. In fact, it is even very clear that our policy at home is to try to solve social problems through military means, just as we have done abroad. The interrelatedness of domestic and foreign affairs is no longer questioned. The bombs we drop on the people of Vietnam continue to explode at home with all of their devastating potential. And so I would invite you to join us in Washington in our efforts to enable the poor people of this nation to enjoy a fair share of America's blessings. As rich as ours should be blighted by poverty, disease, and illiteracy. It is plain that we don't care about our poor people except to exploit them as cheap labor and victimize them through excessive rent and consumer prices. Our Congress passes laws which subsidize corporation farms, oil companies, airlines, and houses for suburbia. But when they turn their attention to the poor, they suddenly become concerned about balancing the budget and cut back on funds for Head Start. The most tragic of these cuts is the welfare section to the Social Security Amendment, which freezes federal funds for millions of needy children who are desperately poor but who do not receive public assistance. It forces mothers to leave their children and accept work or training, leaving their children to grow up in the streets as tomorrow's social. This law must be repealed. And I encourage you to join Welfare Mothers on May 12th, Mother's Day, and call upon Congress to establish a guaranteed annual income instead of these racist and archaic measures. These measures which dehumanize God's children and create more social problems than they solve. We will be marching toward Washington soon. On Thursday, May 2nd, we will return to Memphis to begin where my husband was slain and kick off his poor people's campaign. We will be marching toward Washington to demand that America share its abundant life with all its citizens. We should arrive in Washington.
I don't think that my husband, although he said he was going to go back.
This is Corella Scott King, Dr. King Willow. I think she endured more than anybody in America, losing her husband, losing a father, and the children. So she suffered for America to be free. We find ourselves with assault rifles. We find ourselves in the middle of racism and white supremacy. We find ourselves lack of jobs, hungry, people setting people on fire. We find ourselves in the midst of evil. We find ourselves in the midst of black magic. We find ourselves in the midst of white magic. People turning back from God. I want to hear from Coretta the last little of speeches. But I think it would do people good to understand what she endured and what happened as she endured. And that's important to understand the stuff she endured and what she went through. Sometimes you have to understand the sickness of a country. Right now, the blood, they're putting bodies away. It was shocking to see little children to be killed and see how mothers crying, their daughters, their sons are gone, not there no more. So it's important for us to take charge of what happened to us in our life. In the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King, Dr. King is in the spirit realm and teaching us from the spirit realm how we should act, and we hold on to truth. Never give up the truth for a lie. And I think the important thing in 68, man of peace, and so much happened in 68, death of Dr. King, and all that happened, but it was the joy of peace and love at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And we have to hear the word of Martin Luther King saying there is America. People being shot down. Stop the killing, save the babies. What that got to happen, me and you, sisters and brothers, black, brown, and red, enough is enough. The blood of all those children up in Buffalo, New York, up in Texas, is on Congress. The blood is on the hand of the Republican Party. They can't lie and trick out of them.
Dean Mateo, Mr. Bell, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen. Now, there are several things that one could talk about before such a large, concerned, and enlightened audience. There are so many problems facing our nation and our world that one could just take off anywhere. But today I would like to talk mainly about the race problem, since I'll have to rush right out and go to New York to talk about Vietnam tomorrow, and I've been talking about it a great deal this week and weeks before that. But I'd like to use as a subject on which to speak this afternoon the other America. And I use this subject because there are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for a situation. Many centuries America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, culture and education for their minds, freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions. They find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In a sense, the greatest tragedy of this other America is what it does to little children. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental sky. As we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are Appalachian whites. Probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size and the population is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty. A ghetto is to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now let me say that the struggle for civil rights and the struggle to make these two Americas one America is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade or maybe 12 years, we struggled all across the South in glorious struggle to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodation. Public transportation was segregated. Often we had to sit in the back, and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. The struggle was to deal with these problems. Certainly they were difficult problems. They were humiliating conditions. By the thousands, we protested these conditions. We made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousand students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream, seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation, who appeared before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma movement in 1965, we were able to get a voting rights bill. All of these things represented strife. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. So today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. Not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of our people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, but Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. So the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. and the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than white. As we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate, the nation as a whole, is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes is about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs until they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long, desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. So they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 to 7% in the Negro community. That means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. Among Negroes in large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. So you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many others didn't see too well during the last 10 years, that is still alive in American society, much more widespread than we realize. We must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race, is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flaw of history. And the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved, innately impure, and innately inferior. And in analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man. Carried racism to its logical conclusion. We ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. This is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, if one says that I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him, merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use the philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very